Good morning. The tax committee will come to order. And members, we're finally getting back to what we wanted to do in the beginning of the year, which was get an overview of the tax structure in Minnesota. And we kind of got sidetracked with all these other hearings we've been having, joint hearings and House 95. So I think we're back on track. And members, we asked everyone to save the big handouts when we were doing this before. They should be in your save folder. If you don't have them, the pages can get to what you need. So I think we were going to go back to Ms. Manzi. Before that, if I could get a motion for the minutes of the of January 20th, January 21st, and January 26th. Who said that? Representative Davis?
Representative David.
Okay, Representative David moves the minutes of January 20th, January 21st, and January 26th. Questions or changes to the minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion carries. So with that, we're going to start with, what page are we on, Ms. Manzi? Is it, I don't recall. We're on the Working Family Credit, I think.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nina Manzi from the Health Research Department. When we left off, we had just finished with the Working Family Credit, which is the slide 21 on page 7 of the handout for the overview. So we'll be starting with the K-12 Education Credit, which is on the top of page 8. To refresh your memories about these credits, we talked a little bit last time about how there are non-refundable credits and refundable credits. We completed going through the non-refundable credits and have started on the refundable credits. The difference, again, is that non-refundable credits may only be used to reduce tax liability, where if you have a refundable credit, then if you don't have any tax liability, you still get the full amount of the credit issued to you as a refund by the Department of Revenue. So it's like a transfer payment. The largest of those is the Working Family Credit, which we talked about 2 weeks ago. And then the next one that we come to is the K-12 Education Credit. After the hearing, the last time we discussed these, Cynthia and I were talking about these, and we realized that all of the estimates for the credits in this overview are taken from the Department of Revenue's tax expenditure budget, and that was last prepared a year ago. So there have been changes in the economy and in what the Department of Revenue and the Department of Finance think about these credits since then. So I want to let you know that if there were to be a proposal to modify one of these credits or to repeal one of these credits, the revenue cost would be somewhat different from what appears in this overview. But the expenditure budget is really the most recent thing that we have for these, because when they do the forecast, they don't provide detail on all of the credits.
Excuse me, Ms. Nancy. Are there people who don't have this? Has everyone found these? Because, again, the pages have them if you can't find as we follow on. We want to encourage questions from members on everything Ms. Manzi covers. Thank you.
Okay, the K-12 Education Credit was enacted in 1998, and it offsets a portion of eligible K-12 education expenses. It initially offset 100% of the first $1,000 of expenses for qualifying low-income families. After a few years, that was reduced to 75%. There were some issues. You may have noticed the articles in the newspaper during the last week about Cyber Study 101 and a woman who's been indicted federally for various fraud counts. And they were providing online tutoring services to low-income people in exchange for what they billed as a free computer. Then they were charging them for the online tutoring services, and they were filing tax returns on their behalf and claiming the K-12 education credit. So it worked out to be a good deal for them because it was a one-for-one credit. They could get $1,000 for each for the first two eligible children from these low-income families. And it was partly in response to that the administration came forward with a proposal in the early part of this decade to reduce the credit percentage to 75%, and that reduced the frequency of those sorts of issues where there were somewhat unscrupulous providers of education-related services taking advantage of low-income families. So this credit will be 75% of eligible expenses. The maximum is $1,000 per child. Eligible expenses are everything that's eligible for that K-12 subtraction that we talked about 2 weeks ago, except for tuition. So it would count as textbooks, academic summer camps, the first $200 of computer software and hardware, transportation if you have to pay someone else to transport your child to school, instructional materials required for school, so if you have to buy pencils and paper for the student to take to school with them. Musical instruments are included, as are musical instrument lessons, including, I think, piano lessons. It's subject to an income-based phase-out that starts when household income reaches $33,500. When the phase-out ends depends on how many qualifying children there are in the family. This was changed a couple of years ago to remove what was called a family cap on the credit. Earlier, you could get the credit of $1,000 per child, but the maximum was $2,000 per family, so it effectively limited it to two children in grades K through 12. It was increased to be $1,000 per child, regardless of how many children it was claimed for. And then the phase-out runs from $33,500 to $37,500 for the first two children, and it extends for another $2,000 for each additional child for whom the credit is claimed. And that extension of the phase-out keeps there from being a very sharp phase-out rate for this credit. There already is a fairly steep one, but we had to extend it out farther as we added more children, and the amount of credit that a family could claim got bigger. There are some families that have shown up in our income tax sample who are claiming this credit for, I think there are a handful who are claiming it for five or six children. So there are some families who have taken advantage of the removal of the family cap. Neither the credit amount nor the phase-out score are adjusted for inflation. Eligible expenses, I talked about a little bit already. Tutoring, books, transportation fees, music lessons, up to $200 of software or hardware. The total cost of the credit is projected at $13.6 million in fiscal year 2009. The average amount claimed is $265 in tax year 2006, which is the last year we have data for, and there were almost 56,000 people claiming this credit in 2006.
Excuse me, Ms. Manzi, Representative Wofford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Manzi. You mentioned the cyber study fraud case, and what I was surprised about with that article was that the credit, it appeared from the article, was paid directly to cyber study, not to the family being served, and that seemed to me a pretty unusual situation and potentially opens up either more fraud. And is that unusual? Is this the only credit where someone can actually have the money paid to someone else rather than to the return filer?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, first I think I should say that this is an open case, so I don't want to say anything that assumes that the cyber study people are guilty of anything at this point since it's going forward. But my understanding of what was happening at the time is that they would have low-income families who otherwise had no exposure to the income tax. They maybe didn't have any wages. They didn't have anything that required them to file an income tax return. And as part of signing up for their online tutoring program, they would have those families sign over a power of attorney authorizing them to file a tax return on their behalf. So that's how the refunds were paid to CyberStudy, is that they got the families to authorize them to file returns for them. And they did. And then there was, you know, the Department of Revenue had a lot of problems because not all of these families understood what they had signed, and so some of them then tried to file their own return, so they were getting multiple returns for the same family, and that's part of what led them to propose reducing the credit rate to 75%.
Representative Wofford?
Well, just to follow up, I can see where if you have a senior who's having family members help them fill out their tax return, you should be able to use a power of attorney to do that, but this seems sort of an abuse of that sort of thing, and I would hope that we could look into that because it seems like that opens the door to a broad range of issues.
Thank you, Representative Wofford. And I hope members, when you hear about all these tax expenditures and credits and deductions, are thinking about which ones we could cut. So, I think when you look at the state health credits, you could look at any of the credits we're going through and you could think about, should they really be for all these purposes? Should they go to who? I think those are the questions we have to think about with all the credits. But reforming any sort of potential for abuse would be important as well. But I do think as you hear Ms. Manzi walk through them, it makes people wonder why we have some of them, and you know what the legislature was thinking at the time they gave them, and should we, can we still afford them? So I appreciate that. Can I also just take a minute to let committee members know and the audience know that Ms. Manzi's mother is here from San Diego, Ruth Manzi, right there. She came all the way from San Diego, and she gets to watch her daughter today. You know, I should just say to your mom, Nina, that you probably know that Nina and I went to graduate school together, and I don't want to embarrass her too much, but she was absolutely the best, most organized, brilliant student, and I know that doesn't surprise you, but I'm sure it has something to do with you as her mother. So we really love that you're here today, and Ms. Manzi works, of course, for all Minnesotans and all members, and she really does us proud as she informs us on all her work, and we really do appreciate, we're really glad you're here with us, so welcome. Have I embarrassed you enough now?
Maybe, Madam Chair, maybe your mom has brought some pictures from her youth that we could show. If you really want to keep it going, we could really embarrass you.
That's right. Thank you. Ms. Manzi.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Very kind of you. Moving on to the dependent care credit. This is the oldest of Minnesota's refundable credits. It's tied to the federal credit for dependent care expenses. Our maximum credit equals $720 if you have dependent care expenses for one child, $1,440 if you have expenses for two or more children. Those are tied to the maximum amount for the federal credit that were in place until the late 1990s or early part of this decade. At that time, the federal credit was increased, and we chose not to increase our credit, but to leave it at the lower amount. The increase in the federal credit is one of those items that has a sunset under federal law, so the federal credit will be dropping back down to these levels in the next few years, absent new federal legislation to extend their increased credit. The state credit, unlike the federal credit, is subject to an income-based phase-out. The phase-out starts at around $23,000 of household income in 2009, and then the credit is not available to people with incomes over about $37,000. That phase-out is adjusted annually for inflation. I should say that the credit is calculated more or less as a percentage of dependent care expenses. So the higher your expenses, the bigger your credit is up to when you hit the maximum credit. And most people who have a child in a child care center will be at the maximum credit because the maximum qualifying expenses are less than what people typically pay for a child care center. If you're paying expenses to someone to watch your child after school, or if you have a very good deal at a family daycare home, then you might be at less than the maximum. Another group of people who are below the maximum are people who are on the basic sliding fee program. That program, some of you may be familiar with, subsidizes a portion of child care costs, and the amount it subsidizes depends on your income. So the higher your income, the less the subsidy you receive. But at all income levels, there's a copay amount, and people are allowed to claim the dependent care credit for what they pay in their copay. So that's another reason that you have people at less than the maximum. If they have a very low copay, then they'll have low expenses of their own, but they still can claim the credit for that portion that they do pay themselves. The credit is estimated at $13.9 million in fiscal 2009. The average is $383 in tax year 2006, and just about 36,000 taxpayers claimed it. So you see the average is quite a bit less than the maximum, and that's due to people claiming the credit for one reason or another for less than the maximum expenses, and also due to there being a lot of people who are in the phase-out range who claim the credit. When you're in the phase-out range, you're not eligible for that maximum, but for something smaller.
Excuse me, Ms. Manzi, just thinking about the dependent care credit, it, It seems that most of the money in this area is actually carried in Representative Flawick's area, in the, that committee, through child care subsidies. How do we know as tax committee members, if we wanted to do some work in here to either cut it, increase it, repeal it, whatever, how do we figure out the incidence of who's receiving benefits in child care? How would you work with both the appropriation side and the tax expenditure side? And does revenue try to track who's getting these monies based on ability to pay? Is there any attempt to combine them?
Madam Chair, I don't know if anyone has any data on how much people who get the dependent care credit are receiving in basic sliding fee child care, some of them are also going to be eligible for MFIP child care during their transition year. We would have to have that isn't part of your income tax return, so I don't have that data in the income tax sample. I can do a distribution from the income tax sample of who gets the credit and how much they get, and it's going to tend to follow the phase-out pattern for the credit, but I can't tell how many of those people have had other child care subsidies available. And I think that, I don't know, maybe Mr. Michael knows if there was any child care subsidy information in there was a linked data set between the Department of Revenue and the Department of Human Services that an analyst who is no longer with our office works with quite a bit, and I don't know if that had child care subsidy information in it. I know it had welfare benefit information in it, and I just don't recollect if the child care piece was in there.
Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, I think the data set that Ms. Manzi is referring to, I don't believe includes the basic sliding fee information. Paul Wilson, the director of the research division at Revenue, several years back, did a one-time study that tried to compare, who was on the two and what the effects were. But I think that's probably the only effort that was made, and that was sort of done on a one-time basis.
Okay, because I do think, again, we all have to be thinking about which of these things we can cut or reform or change, since that's what this year is going to require. And I know Representative Wofford has a question. I'm just trying to think about it because I was whispering to Mr. Michael here, and he reminded me that, I was asking, couldn't you just get rid of this credit and give the money to the Flawick Committee, whatever, in the targeting process? I think we have to think about this as we clean up the tax code and we go through all these cuts. I'm not saying we should. Please don't react. But so Mr. Michael reminded me that Governor Ventura attempted to do just that. So we do need to really get creative on all these tax expenditures that are going on in the tax code. Representative Wofford.
Madam Chair, I think that's a great idea to start integrating the two, because right now, I know at one time the waiting list for sliding fee child care subsidy was like 7,000 families. I have no idea what it is now. But it's sort of like you have people who are double winners. They get rich income tax break and they get the sliding fee, while other people are sitting on a waiting list and might be above the eligibility. And so there's some real inequities that we should look at in combining the two, or at least looking at it in a more holistic way.
Thank you. Ms. Manzi.
We're moving into some of our newer and smaller credits. The military service credit starting this month equals $120 for each month that an individual serves in a combat zone. That's an increase from just under $60 per month for months from September 2001 through December 2008. This is payable as a refund, so it's really analogous to a bonus for members of the military who are serving in combat zones. When it was enacted, there was a catch-up provision going back to 2001 so that in the first year it was available, you could get the credit for however many months had been served since then in a combat zone. And the credit also allows for surviving spouses or dependent children to claim the credit for people who were killed in a combat zone. And I think that was expanded last year to include the estate of the service member if there is neither a surviving spouse nor a dependent child. This credit was estimated to cost $1.1 million in fiscal year 2009. That reflects tax year 2008 when the credit was at $59 per month, so it doubles in following years. The average has been $414 per claimant. It's going to double when the credit amount doubles next year to $828, and there are 2,600 roughly people claiming this per year. The number of claimants has been smaller than what revenue initially anticipated, and we think that there may be people out there who are eligible for this credit who simply aren't claiming it, although the Department of Military Affairs has done some publicity on it. But if any of you, you know, interact with service members in your areas, you may want to let them know that this credit exists, because it's a nice little bonus. The bovine tuberculosis credit equals a percentage of testing costs for people who have cattle herds people who have cattle herds anywhere in the state, because the entire state is required to do testing for bovine tuberculosis since there was a recurrence of it in northwest Minnesota last year. The cost was $0.8 million in fiscal 2007. This is going to be increasing in fiscal 2009 because of the recurrence of the bovine tuberculosis. This had been 50% of testing costs for all cattle owners. It was reduced last session to be only 25% for corporate owners, 50% for non-corporate owners, and the savings from that piece was put into a new property tax provision related to bovine tuberculosis. So that's why that change took place. In case you're thinking that going from 50 to 25% is a big reduction, it is a big reduction. Particularly, people have a lot of cattle herds, but the testing costs tend to be $10 per calf for this. So it's, the cost for any individual cow for the test is not very big. The motor fuels credit for low-income filers was enacted last year as part of the transportation finance bill. This equals $25 per return for married joint, single, and head of household filers, and half of that amount for married separate filers. It's available for all taxpayers who have taxable income below where the second tax rate starts, so in the 5.35% bracket. I'm going to look back and see where that is, because I know there's a chart. Yes, on page 4 of the handout, slide 12, it shows you the brackets for married joint filers. So in tax year 2009, this is going to apply to married joint filers with taxable income up to $33,220. For a family with two children, their gross income to be at that taxable income level would be over $20,000 higher, because they have a standard deduction of just over $10,000 and then four personal exemptions of $3,650, I believe. So people could have adjusted gross income of up to around $55,000 and be eligible for this $25 credit. That's why the cost is estimated to be so high. It's $29.8 million in fiscal 10, which is the first fiscal year where the cost will show up for this. Another thing to note about this credit is that it's available, since it's a refundable credit, to people who have no income tax liability or no other requirement to file returns. The department anticipates that there will be some people filing returns to claim this credit who don't have any other reason to file an income tax return.
Representative Silver.
Madam Chair, thank you. Is this funded from the transportation account? Or our general fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Stolberg, I think I'm going to defer to Ms. Dalton and Mr. Michael on this. I believe there is a transfer of a portion of sales tax related to motor vehicles.
I mean, it's a good question, Representative Stolberg, because I think we have a problem here that you're probably alluding to that is probably going to need to get corrected in the omnibus tax bill. Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, we're actually going to talk about this a little later in the dedication of the motor vehicle, the sales tax revenue on motor vehicle leases.
We'll wait.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right, now I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Templin, who is going to speak a little bit about sales tax revenues, and then we'll move to Ms. Dalton to talk about the details on sales tax.
Madam Chair, again, I'm Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I will be covering just the introductory slides on sales tax, and Representative Solberg's question is on page 41, in case you can't, in case there's any suspense in knowing what the what the dedicated funds for the motor fuels credit. We will eventually get to that. Right now, we're about a third way through the entire presentation, so I will kind of pick up the pace in these introductory slides. Okay, we're all set up. Sales tax is $4.9 billion in fiscal 2009. And $405 million of that is motor vehicle sales tax, or also known as MVEST. Slightly under one-third of state tax revenue, or 29.3%. And businesses, according to the tax incidence report by the Department of Revenue, 44% of businesses pay this tax before shifting. And another kind of sidebar about sales tax, about 1% of sales tax applied statewide generates about $650 million. This slide shows a trend line for sales tax revenue for 10 years. And generally speaking, this trend line shows receipts increasing or staying relatively flat until 2008, where we see a slight decline. The next slide is the tax incidence slide, and this slide shows the burden of sales tax on Minnesota households. The first quintile shows the 20% of the poorest households in Minnesota, and how this group pays the burden is 6.1%. They pay that percent of their income on this tax. Compared to the richest quintile, the fifth quintile pays 2.1% of their income to this tax.
Thank you. Excuse me, Representative Reinhart and then Rukavina. Representative Reinhart. Oh, I'm Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back to something you said that went by really quickly and make sure I understood. You said that, did you say 1% addition on the sales tax statewide generates $650 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Chair. Is this an income quintile or the population quintile?
Ms. Champlin.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, I believe it's population.
What would happen if we did it in deciles? What would the first decile jump to? Because we used to get it in deciles, but I think Valenti administration went to quintiles, so when let's go back.
I think we did that. Well, Tim Rukavina, I'll just say that I asked when we were going to do these overviews. I haven't seen any of this until we're doing it, but I did ask Mr. Michael at the beginning of the year, it would be great if as we do the major taxes, we could just have a slide on incidents. So I guess I didn't know if it would be in deciles or quintiles, and I don't know if it's just an income population. But as you know, when we do the incidents report, we'll really get into it, but I wanted members to see it kind of as we go, how regressive some of these taxes are. But Representative Rukavina, I think, is right on. It's probably more regressive than what we're looking at. Is that what you're going for there, Representative Rukavina?
Well, right. Madam Chair, and I think if you went to, you know, deciles, it would be worse. And then if you went to income deciles instead of population, it would be, but maybe I'm wrong, even worse yet.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, the incidence study still reports things based on deciles. And just because there's only so much room to do graphs, we made the decision to combine the deciles into quintiles. You're going to see the same pattern. You just see more detail with the deciles. The other point that Representative Rukavina is making with regard to income versus population, these quintiles or the deciles, in the incidence study basically takes the population of the whole population of the state and sorts it. So if you want to think of it, you just array the population. You take the person with the lowest income at the bottom and the person with the highest income at the top, and you just say we're going to divide, and they're all in order, and we're going to divide that into 10 slices or 5 slices. Those are population deciles. Whereas if you take income deciles, then you say, well, we're not going to take, you know, 1/5 of the population, but instead we're going to say we're going to take 1/5 of the income. And so you get quite a different perspective on that distribution by using income deciles than population. The incidence study reports them both ways. There are tables. I think most analysts tend to prefer the population because the income at the top end can be so concentrated that when you're looking at, say, the top 5% or the top 1%, you're looking at only just that really a handful of people. So, but it's useful to look at them both ways, but this is sort of the more standard way that it's done, and so that's the explanation.
That's Ruth Avina, what's in the cabinet there?
And Mama Manzi, I guess. You have an excellent daughter, by the way. She gets me all this information, but she's updating this for me. I just want Mother Manzi to know this. So, I mean, this is the 54 people I'm talking about at the talk for example. So, okay, that's all I want. We'll have an updated version for the floor.
And that's a really important point. We have to spend a lot of time on this. That's been Ruth Avina's right on.
I mean,
with limited resources, we all have to
open
up.
No, I
get
mean,
what?
You know, and I'll ask.
The Republicans are gone.
Everyone.
They must be getting briefed on the budget.
I moved the final.
I think so.
Based on income.
I'll accept that as a friendly
message. But Matt, sure, that was my point, because if you look at, you know, and I'm just going by memory when we first started looking at the Jack Simpson studies in depth here, and you were a member of this committee, and we'd see it in income deciles, and you would be shocked that, you know, 900,000 households, not even, you know, people, but households lived on the same equal amount of income as 9,000 people at the top, yet their tax incidence is over double. So, you know, it's important how you play with, like Walt Troth used to say, our own state rep figures don't lie, but liar figures. So, you know, we have to look at that when we look at these incidence studies.
Yeah. Thank you. Ms. Gretchen Reinert? I think I saw your name. Is that Ron crossed out? Okay. I'm sorry. Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair and Representative Recovina, the data for the presentation of the quintiles comes from page 39 of the tax incidence book, which shows it by deciles. And that table will be updated in March, and I'm sure will be reported in detail soon. So moving on then to the percent of taxes paid. This, of the total sales taxes paid, this slide shows the share of total taxes paid for each quintile. For example, the first quintile, which is the lowest income, 20% of the lowest income paid, 7.2%. And the highest or the richest quintile paid 42.8% of total sales taxes collected.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pat Dalton from House Research, and I'm going to start by taking you through the distribution of sales tax revenues. A little bit more than 90% of sales tax revenues go to the general fund, but there are some dedications, and those dedications are motor vehicle sales tax, the sales tax on motor vehicle leases, which is subject to the general sales tax, lottery in-lieu payments, and beginning July 1 of this year, the revenue from the 3/8 of 1% rate increase that was passed in the constitutional amendment. So, dedication of motor vehicle sales tax. This was a constitutional dedication, and the amendment was passed in the 2006 election. Prior to the amendment, 54% of the motor vehicle sales tax, or MVAS, was dedicated to transportation. And this is being phased into 100% by fiscal year 2012. The Constitution required that no more than 60% of the dedication go to roads and no less than 40% go to transit. What happened statutorily is they actually statutorily imposed that 60-40 split. This slide shows the phase-in to the total dedication. 73.75% of MVEF is dedicated in 2009. It goes up 10% a year. So by fiscal year 2012, 100%, which is estimated to be $501 million, will be dedicated to transportation and transit. In fiscal year 2009, $106 million of MVEF still goes to the general fund. As you can see, this is going to be going down, so you're just seeing what the loss is to the general fund. The second dedication, which will actually get to Representative Solberg's question, is the dedication on the sales tax on motor vehicle leases. Motor vehicle leases aren't subject to MVEF. They are subject to the general sales tax. So they were not part of the constitutional dedication. However, a statutory dedication was enacted last year, and it begins in fiscal 2011. The dedication is also done over a four-year over a period, so it's fully phased in by fiscal 2013. The amount dedicated to outside of the general fund is the revenue from the leases minus the amount of the motor fuel tax credit that that Ms. Manzi discussed earlier, and that Representative Solberg was asking about. The motor fuel tax credit is about $30 million a year, and this amount actually exceeds the amount of motor vehicle lease tax revenue in a couple of years.
Madam Chair, what was the number for the motor vehicle lease? Was it 10 million?
And it's declining, right? I mean, dropping.
If they don't have...
Isn't the tax on motor vehicle lease cars significantly higher than the state sales tax rate? It's like 12.8 or something?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's where it gets a little confusing. We have the sales tax on long-term motor vehicle leases, and that's the same as the tax on motor vehicle sales. And then we have what are called the rental car leases, and those are additional taxes on short-term motor vehicle leases. Those are not dedicated.
So you rent the car at the airport?
Right. And those are an additional 6.2% above the general fund.
And that goes,
general rate of 6.2%.
That goes into the general fund as opposed to being dedicated into transportation. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the short-term rental car tax is not dedicated to transit and transportation.
And that tax would be probably more a higher rate of being exported to non-Minnesotans than the other chunk. Is that right?
Madam Chair, yes, that would be correct.
That's been looking
to that point. Yeah. So then if I go to the local GM dealer in Virginia and I have to rent a car from them for 2 days, which tax do I pay?
Madam Chair, Representative Rusevina, you will pay the higher tax.
So I don't know if we export it or not, because a lot of our constituents have to get their car fixed, and then they rent, they get a car. And I think it was an issue, and I don't know if it ever got resolved, that whether they should pay the higher
right.
one or the lower one. Is there a constitutional question to charge a, if it's an in-state, you know, if it's from a local dealer, that it could be the lower of the rate?
I think it was how they're leased, and I think it was mostly to the better deals are the people at the airport. It seems counter to, I mean, I agree with you, it doesn't sound like it's working right. I don't think any of this stuff should be dedicated, but I lost that fight.
No.
It should all be in the general fund, in my opinion. But, Ms. Dalton, do you, can you respond to what Representative Rukavina's...
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, I think we start getting into some airport issues if we have a tax on short-term leases that applies only to out-of-state residents, because the vast majority of the tax paid by out-of-state residents on short-term leases tends to occur at the airport, and there's some requirements about not having discriminatory taxes at the airport. At the airport, or if you do, all of it must go to fund the airport. So if it essentially became a tax solely on, you know, car rentals at the airport, it couldn't go into the revenue couldn't go into the general fund. It would have to actually go back to the airport to fund airport the airport.
Madam Chair, would there be a way for us to know if we are exporting this tax, or if our citizens are paying the lion's share of it, or half of it, or whatever?
Yeah.
Is there a way to get that information?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, I think maybe the best we could do is to try to split out how much of the motor vehicle rentals in the state are occurring at the airport versus at, you know, in the rest of the state. And I think there's some information on that, because we have kind of looked at what would happen if we imposed a motor a tax on motor vehicle leases in short-term motor vehicle rentals in Hennepin County, when we were looking at alternative ways of funding some of the ballparks. So I think we have some information on it. I don't have any with me right now.
Ms. Dalton, is this the same issue that, you know, some members were trying to find ways to fund things last year in bill form that may or may not have been introduced? I think one was a revenue stream, say, for the Mall of America with using airport taxes. Do you remember all this, where people were kind of looking at airport taxes, and maybe Mr. Michael's person to ask, wasn't this sort of the same issue that you can't just single out the airport, and that the FAA or the Fed say, I might have that wrong, but Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there, as Ms. Dalton pointed out, the FAA has what are called revenue diversion rules that prevents you from imposing a tax targeted at the airport and not using it to pay for the cost of the airport. So you're stuck with alternative of imposing a tax in a whole jurisdictional area. So it could be, you know, in the metropolitan area, it could be in the county, even though, you know, for example, in Hennepin County, most of that tax would fall on leases at the airport. And that presumably would not be a diversion, because it would be a, you know, a countywide tax. And this, obviously, proposals on this have been made, and it's used in many other states to finance things like stadiums and ballparks and convention centers and that sort of thing. To Representative Rukavina's question, I don't know that we have data on how many rental cars or how much is spent on rental cars by residents as opposed to non-residents. We'd have to check with, you know, with revenue if they've got some way of estimating that.
But you must have it, Mr. Michaels, by airport rentals versus dealership rentals.
I'm not sure if they know if it's by dealership rentals, but it's they know what the rentals are at the airport, because they can get information from MAC, and they can probably get it also from the handful of other airports in other cities in Minnesota. What they can't distinguish is some of the big rental car companies, like Hertz and Avis and so forth, also have sites off of the airport that are separate from a car dealer that's just, you know, doing a little bit of incidental renting. I'm not sure that they can make that distinction. We'd have to talk to them.
Forward.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe it was used in the past as a revenue stream and not dedicated, but I thought, at least at some particular point in history, that that tax was increased on car rentals to be able to fund a project or a something. Maybe it was just a discussion of the ballpark at one time. But I, if I recall right, I thought that at that particular time the rental was like 9% of it as opposed to 6. I mean, it wasn't the double amount. So I think it's been increased, but not probably dedicated. But it's increased as a way of, this is fine with paying for my favorite bill to come through.
Mr. Michael?
Square? Yeah, I'm sure that. I think that's an accurate.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Stolberg, the tax on short-term motor vehicle leases has changed and increased over time. At one time, it was just a flat per-day tax, and then I think it was in the late 90s that we actually changed it to a percentage tax.
Ms. Dalton, not to kill us on this, didn't the governor propose this? Wasn't this the governor's thing, the motor vehicle lease? Dedication? Isn't that where this all came from a couple of years ago? When we started, I guess it's not fair to ask you, but I thought it was in the governor's proposal.
It was
a tax increase.
No, the
dedication part.
The dedication taking it out of the general fund and putting it in that.
To the banner. Okay. Just trying to remember where it even came from, but yeah, okay. Thank you.
Members of the committee, this slide actually shows you how much money is actually being dedicated from the sales tax on long-term motor vehicle leases. And as you can see, for fiscal 11, it's less than $1 million. In fiscal 12, it's zero. And that's actually because for that year, 93% of the lease revenue is dedicated. But that amount is less than the amount of the projected motor fuel credit by about $1.5 million. So there will be no transfer in fiscal year 12. Once we are up to 100% dedication minus the fuel credit, you will start seeing that number go positive again beginning in fiscal year 13.
Madam Chair?
Representative Palmer.
Can you repeat that again so I can follow that?
Well, and Representative Rukavina should hear that too. I think Representative Shumper and Representative Rukavina worked on this, and I think the intention was to not have a regressive tax that was going to be raised in the omnibus transportation bill, disproportionately hurt the poor, and they were attempting to have an income credit at the lower end, which I think most people think was a good idea. I think the structure of this now is sort of problematic, and the timing of the bills where it was in a transportation bill as opposed to a tax bill, and then now the dedicated fund to pay for the low-income credit doesn't even create enough money. So, Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Stolberg, essentially the amount of the motor vehicle lease sales tax revenue that's dedicated starts at 83%, goes to 93%, and then goes to 100%. And it's from that 83, 93, or 100% that you subtract off the motor vehicle, the motor fuel credit. That amount has gone down since last year. The forecast amounts for those have gone down since last year, significantly. And so 83% is barely enough to cover the motor fuel credit this year, but there is a anticipated decline in the sales tax and motor vehicle leases for the next year, and so 93% of that will not cover what is anticipated to be the fuel credit. So there will actually be, the fuel credit will cost $1.5 million more than 93% of what is raised on in sales tax and motor vehicle leases. So there will be no money dedicated out of the general fund, and the motor fuels credit will actually cost the state $1.5 million more than they had anticipated. So
Ms. Dalton, do we believe that anyone's actually going to file for this and that 29 point something million is really going to happen? When will we know the, you know, how long will it take us to really see if people are really going to file for that? As was stated, you know, a bunch of people don't even have an income liability, would have to know to go get it.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, I think one of the interesting facts about that, though, is it goes up fairly high. For a family of four, I think Ms. Manzi said you could have an income of $55,000 and qualify for this. And if you have an income of $55,000, you are probably already filing for income tax, so this becomes something that you would just, you know, pick up along with everything else that you're doing.
Madam Chair?
Yes, I'm over.
And that's a per dollar amount as opposed to any kind of a sliding fee. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. when gas is $4, when it's a plus 50, probably less important to have that. But it doesn't slide at all.
I think Representative Rucavina would disagree since the tax is the same because it's based on a gallon, not the price.
Okay.
Representative Rucavina?
It's the same. And what is it, 20, whatever it is now, regardless of whether it's $4 a gallon or...
But Representative Rucavina, I mean, I think, do you see the need to maybe rework this a little bit? Because I think you were right on, but I think that the mechanics need to be changed a little bit for it to work right. Because it's not going to get funded, is how it appears.
Does it have...
We have no choice.
But it has to be funded,
right?
Isn't it?
I guess it could have been, you know, it could be folded into the working family credit, so more getting that way, you could... I don't know. I just think we should work on it.
I was just trying to keep our tax system somewhat progressive.
And I guess I'm arguing you could make it even more progressive by putting it into some vehicle like that. But we could think about it. Ms. Dalton.
Moving on to the last dedication we're going to talk about, and that's the dedication of the in-lieu tax on lottery tickets. That tax raises about $31 million, and about 72% of it, or $23 million of it, is dedicated revenues. 50% of that dedication goes to the Heritage Enhancement Account for... And 50% goes to the Natural Resource Fund. Of the amount going to the Natural Resource Fund, 48% of the 50% goes for trails and 2% goes for zoos. Then we get to talk about our brand new dedication. The 0.3875% tax increase, or the 3/8 tax increases. It's all long percentage. And none of us will be able to figure out our sales tax in our heads anymore. which is unfortunate. Anyway, this tax increase is going to be effective for 20 years under the Constitution. It is constitutionally dedicated. Revenue from it for fiscal year 2010 is estimated to be about $242 million. One-third of it will go to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, one-third to the Clean Water Fund, and the remaining one-third will be split between Parks and Trails and Arts and the Cultural Heritage Fund.
Mr. Marquardt.
Thank you very much. It's a mathematical question. I mean, it was called a 3/8 cent increase, which should have been 0.375, and yet it's 0.3875. What was the accuracy?
It was 3/8. Oh, I'm sorry. It's supposed to be 0.375, not 3/8.
Oh, okay, so what that? I thought it might have been just called.
That's
okay,
a
very
typo
good.
In my slide.
Very good.
It's the calculator over there. You know. That's fair.
I'm still not going to be able to do it in my head.
No. Having been around here a long time, and I thought I pretty much knew these taxes, but I want to go back to slide 42 and the in-lieu tax on lottery tickets so I understand it, because right now when you buy a lottery ticket, I thought 60% of the after prize revenues went to the general fund and 40% to the, we'll call it the Willard Munger Trust Fund or whatever you want to call it.
This isn't the Madam Chair, Representative Lugavina, this isn't the dedication of the lottery revenues. Lottery tickets are not subject to the sales tax.
I thought they did pay the sales tax.
Instead, the lottery pays gross receipts tax in lieu of the sales tax on the number of tickets they sell. And that's the revenue that is dedicated here.
And that's so that you don't pay $1.065 for a lottery ticket, right? I mean, wasn't that why it was constructed?
So you buy a dollar lottery ticket, and then out of there comes the prizes, and then out of there comes this in lieu of tax.
The 6.5%.
Which is 6.5%, but it's not called a sales tax. And then what's left over after the lottery as administrative fees goes 60-40.
Right.
But this now is statutorily then dedicated, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Versus.
And what is the Heritage Enhancement Account? Is it my... Can the Croatians and Italians my heritage?
Madam Chair, Representative Lucavina, this is a fund in the natural resource account. What exactly it can be used for? I believe it can be used for land acquisition and rehabilitation.
So Madam Chair, this isn't at the LCCMR then. This is at in the Environment and Natural Resource Committee. At the Department of Natural Resources.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucavina, I am not going to swear my life on that, but I believe that's correct.
And so, all of a sudden, another $22 million a year is going to the DNR, and then they come to the LCCMR and they get most of that money, which Representative Carlson knows. And so they're getting money, then they have their game and fish dedicated accounts, and they just keep getting money everywhere.
Representative Lucavina, we should do an informal poll of all tax committee members to see how they voted in the privacy of the booth on that dedication of the new tax, this dedicated tax. Representative Solberg and then Loeffler.
Doesn't this in lieu of tax also apply to charitable gambling as well?
Ms. Dalton. Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I don't believe so, and I'm looking at Joel, and Joel's agreeing with me.
but there is a tax on that as well, is there not?
Yes, Mr. Mike.
General fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes, charitable gambling is subject to a whole panoply of special taxes and is exempt from the sales tax.
And Representative,
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that in lieu sales tax was imposed at the same time the lottery went into effect, and it really was done as sort of a way to, I think it's fair to characterize it as a way to increase the yield to the general fund, and then subsequently some of these interests came in and got whittled away at that general fund revenues and got dedications of that revenue as well.
Representative, remember Representative Hill, who's not here right now, he tried to tackle all that last year, and it got pretty complicated, and then there was the card club tax, and there's a bunch of different taxes in gambling.
And then, sir, I remember when this was in, it was a big rally on the sales tax was put in the general fund specifically for education.
It was?
Well, mm-hmm. We were short on money for education bill, and that's where the money came from. It was a general fund, but it was needed at the time for it.
Huh. Representative Loeffler, I'm sorry. Representative Loeffler, I have a question.
Madam Chair and Ms. Dalton, or maybe it's Mr. Michaels, are these in-lieu taxes, are they calculated on the same rate, that, you know, if they were subjected to the normal 6.5% and et cetera, and it will... they would be increasing with the 3/8% increase, or is that an...
As they look at each other.
Or is that an option?
They don't know, no one knows.
We've been discussing that.
Yeah. That's an Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I believe that it's set, the in-lieu rate is set in statute, and so it does not automatically go up, and it's not clear whether or not the constitutional amendment will cause that in lieu rate to be part of the general sales tax and to go up? I don't know. That, I mean, that's sort of one of the... There are a number of unanswered questions with regard to the, you know, to the 3/8, some of which, you know, probably should be clarified by the legislature. And that's probably one of them. And I guess if that were, I mean, if you were to adjust that rate upward, then I suppose you would put that money into those accounts as opposed to leaving it in the general fund.
Well, there's many complexities here, but I have to say, for those of us who don't have calculator brains, I bought something at Bachman's, a plant, and they actually have on their sales tax how much goes to the state, how much goes to the Minneapolis Convention Center, how much goes to the stadium. I mean, it's pretty interesting. I've never seen that before. And I was just looking at my wallet to see if I still had that receipt with me, but I don't. But
That's never a good
We need to see that.
Still stuck at 42, and I got pictures of the game where I'm getting a new four-wheeler when I buy a lottery ticket. So I just want to know, what's the history? When was this passed? Did you have a history of it for me?
Mentor Representative Rukavina, I'm not carrying the right thing.
This
one,
we were in a tough financial time,
maybe,
and we figured a way to get the DNR more money. And
Mr. Michael?
I'm sure Representative Rukavina, to the contrary, it was the in lieu tax was imposed, as Representative Solberg was saying, this was at the time the sales tax went into effect, because the general fund,
in the
perception of the legislature, needed as much money out of the lottery as possible. And of course the Constitution says 60%, 40% split. And some of the idea was developed that, well, the general sales tax applies to all consumption purchases generally, and so it would be appropriate to say that people who are spending money on the lottery should be subject to the sales tax, and the general fund ought to get a take out of that as a result of that. So that's what led to the enactment of the in lieu tax. But then when times were good and the general fund had extra money or wasn't so tight, that's when the legislature came in and said, well, we'll backtrack on that and dedicate this in lieu tax back to some DNR type or, you know, natural resource type thing. But of course they went above 40%, which would have been if, you know, you just had an exemption for the lottery. And it's up to, as the slide indicates, up to 72%. But it was during times when the general fund was a little better that you know, the advocates for those programs succeeded in getting this dedication.
All the reason. All the more reason, Madam Chair, not to buy lottery tickets.
Ms. Dalton, if Representative Rukavina succeeds in slots and bars, or Representative Kahn with a lottery at the airport, or, you know, anybody, do they follow slide 42? Or would that be you could start anew?
Madam Chair, they would not follow slide 42, because slide 42, the in lieu tax on lottery tickets is strictly the state lottery. It does not apply. I don't think it's written. And don't they disagree with me,
no,
Mr. Michael?
That's not right, because the way that I have the bill drafted, it's done by the lottery, and then so everything would be the same, and so there would be a sales tax, which I just checked this morning because I had the lottery director there, so I'm just giving the game earns more money, so I got to figure
you
out.
You want to change the Representative Rukavina?
Oh yeah, I can
track
that any way I want it.
Yeah, right.
But since you brought up the airport, I guess, you know, and I was thinking earlier what Mr. Michael said about the, you know, the federal FAA rules and that. Could you have a lottery at the airport,
Mr. Michael,
which is a tax and went right to the state general fund,
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, I am not at all an expert on the FAA revenue diversion rules. We'd have to look at that. I'm guessing that, you know, you create a casino at the airport that you probably could take the profits out. Those regulations are directed at differential taxation, and I think that in this case the lottery would be like the government, like the business that's operating the entity, and so you'd be taking the profits out as opposed to the government imposing a differential tax. But that's just a guess on my part without, you know, going into the FDA regulation.
I'll check on that, though.
It's going to be an interesting year.
Madam Chair, before we move off of dedications, Representative Liebling's question actually reminded me that there are going to be a number of issues that will need to be dealt with on that constitutional amendment. The constitutional amendment language was fairly vague. It talked about an increase on the general sales tax. So there are some questions about what does this do to the sales tax on motor vehicle sales, which currently are linked. So does that go up 3/8 or doesn't it? If it doesn't, and motor vehicle leases are taxed under the general sales tax law, 297A, are we now going to tax motor vehicle leases at a different rate than we tax motor vehicle sales? And then how much of that money is dedicated? So there are some issues that need to be dealt with statutorily to actually make the constitutional dedication work. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. So, we're done with dedications now, hopefully, and we're going to just move on to the general sales tax rate. As you all know, the general sales tax rate as of right now is 6.5%. There are special rates on short-term rental motor vehicles. That's a combined rate of 12.7%. And manufactured housing and park trailers are only taxed at 6.5% on 65% of the cost. And that's to make them comparable to residential homes. When you build a residential home, you pay sales tax. Somebody's paying sales tax on the inputs to the construction of that home, but you don't pay sales tax on purchasing the home. And the thought was that about 65% of the cost of constructing a regular home is the materials. So that's why we only tax these alternatives at 65%.
Well, Madam Chair, if we ever extend, as Governor Ventura has suggested, sales tax to labor, what does that do for the construction industry, especially home building?
Madam Chair, Representative Silver, that's a really good question.
And would we then have to change this to have 100%?
If we are taxing construction labor, then I think the answer would be yes.
Okay.
If you wanted to keep equity in the system. Assembly Ling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have another question about this. Okay, I get that, you know, when you build a new home, I guess some portion of it is taxable materials, but doesn't this tax on motor vehicle or manufactured housing get paid every time the home turns over? And you're not, when you turn over a regular home, you're not paying tax on it each time, or at least not sales tax, right?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is actually correct. If the manufactured home is sold by somebody who is in the business of selling manufactured homes, whether it is new or used, you would pay a sales tax on it. If an individual owns a mobile home and then individually sells it, it would not be subject to sales tax. So if, you know, basically if you are in the business, it doesn't matter if it's new or used, it would be subject to sales tax.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you have any idea why we did it that way? It seems to be so nonsensical.
Is this F. M. Murphy's bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy actually brought forward the bill that changed it from taxing 100% of the value to taxing 65% of the value several years ago, probably 10. I hate to think how long I've been here. It was actually 6 points. It was the sales tax on 100% of the value of the motor of the manufactured home. So that has been actually a decrease. I don't know that anyone's ever proposed removing it off of used manufactured homes.
somewhere from Weebling.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I mean, not, I don't want to look for ways to spend more money in the tax bill, but boy, this just seems like, you know, talk about regressive taxes. I mean, I guess I'd like to know, you know, who's buying manufactured homes. I mean, I'm guessing that they're more low-income folks, and we're putting a sales tax on them, and people who buy a big fancy home, I mean, we're, you know, you get a nice deduction on your taxes for that, and you're certainly not paying a sales tax. So, I don't know, this is something that, if we're talking about fairness and simplicity in the tax code, maybe this is something we ought to be looking at.
Mm-hmm. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, then, it sounds like manufactured housing is treated differently with the private transaction of an automobile. This is my understanding of sales tax on the sale of a private automobile to a family member is exempt or not subject to, but if you were to sell it to any other private party when the title was transferred, you lost the private transaction, it is subject to the sales tax.
Ms. Dalton. Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that is correct. So would it solve the problem to just have the tax on the first time new sale, but on a, selling a used trailer, not have the tax? Would that solve both the problems that have been raised with this issue, Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, it would certainly put them on a comparable basis with, you know, on-site construction of homes.
Madam Chair, do they pay the sales tax on the actual purchase price or on the list price? And if I had a used mobile home, or manufactured home, we call it, and traded it in, would I pay on the difference like I do a car?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I'm doing this all from my head. And, you know, I'm not as good at this as Mr. Michael is. But I don't believe we allow trade-ins for anything other than cars.
Seems like stumps the staff.
No?
That's your mic.
Madam Chair, I think my doing this off the top of my head, too. I think in that instance, when a dealer is buying the home, they would be able to buy it exempt because they're going to resell it. So the exemption for resale would apply. And so on one of these transactions, there would only be one tax that would apply and not two. So when the dealer buys the home from the seller, the used home, they're not going to pay the tax on that and then charge the tax on the ultimate sale. But I think all of this points out some of the quirks and the peculiarities of the sales tax. And there are two things in the sales tax, two fundamental things in the sales tax that create these quirks. One is that it only applies to sales of personal property and not real property. And so you have a different result if the mobile home has been attached to real property and you're selling the land with the home and so forth. You know, and so and it's also the quirk that the sales tax only applies to property sales and not services, and those two things interact to create this. And of course the point that Representative Carlson raises is that in the motor vehicle area, we found it convenient to enforce the tax because you have to change the registration, and so it's one of the few areas where you could collect the tax on these private party sales, whereas in the sales tax, we have an occasional sales exemption. So if I'm just selling, you know, if I'm running a garage sale, I don't charge sales tax on it. And that's the sort of the same principle why the individual seller of a mobile home doesn't charge the tax to the buyer, but the dealer does, because they're in the business. And so all of these things result in some real quirks and how different things seem to be treated differently.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah. Madam Chair, another thing that comes to mind when we talk about manufactured housing is a difference if it's put on a permanent foundation. I'm picking up on the fact that here a few moments they used the term trailer, which is the way manufactured housing used to be referred to. They are more frequently. But I could see some of that manufactured housing put on permanent foundation. And then there's another type of manufacturing housing effect that was in the campaign where a couple of years ago turned around a corner and here was a couple of big cranes, and they were listing the component parts that have been manufactured. that's my not do a permanent foundation, but with manufactured housing. I stood there for a couple of hours actually watched the house go up. Incredibly fast period of time that was manufactured. And then I have three homes on Victor Memorial Drive, a very upscale part of my district that were manufactured housing. I hear the robots back from the 1920s or 30s, and you would never guess that they were manufactured housing. By the nature of the neighborhood and the way they look, they're two story colonial. So, how do we separate some of these things with
Ms. Dalton? Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, you are correct. Once something is permanently attached to the land, it becomes real property, not personal property. So any subsequent sales of it would not be subject to the sales tax because we do not impose sales tax on the sale of real property. You're talking about the prefab housing that comes in units and you can put them all together. And yes, that's actually subject to the 6.5% on 65% when purchased, but once it's attached permanently, then any subsequent sale would not be subject to the sales tax.
Thank you. Representative Solberg.
No.
Oh, okay, can we stop there? Can we stop there? Okay, we're adjourned. Thank you.
I feel like this is